Herzlich willkommen. Welcome everybody to the first afternoon talk on the second and last day of ROSCON 12. It's really my pleasure to introduce Vaishali Thakkar. She is from India, works for Oracle, and also has a hand in the Linux kernel. So she will tell us something in what's up in the land of Linux kernel security. And please give a big hand. Thank you.
Thanks for the introduction. So I'm Vaishali Thakkar, and I work as a Linux kernel engineer at Oracle in the kernel security engineering group. And I am also associated with Rails Girl Summer of Code as a co-organizer. And I was also a former intern of Outreachy. So if you have any questions about this program, you can meet me in the hallway afterwards. So let's just start with what this talk is about. So the basic idea behind giving this talk is to have an overview of how Linux kernel security has changed over the times and with the advancement of the technology from the Unix dark security stuff to where we have reached at the point and what are the future challenges over there and how we can address them. So some of the little bit history about Linux as an OS. So Linux is basically, as we all know, a clone of the Unix operating system. And it was written in early 90s. So the core security model of the Unix was a discretionary access control DDoS system. And so basically what Unix dark security model is, we have where dark allows to restrict the access to objects based on the identity of subjects. So for example, there is a user and they want to create a new file and then they can decide who else can read or write to those files. And this policy is basically implemented as permission bits which are attached to the file's inode system and which may be set by the owner of the file, so the root user itself. And permission for accessing the file, like reading or writing the processes of the file itself, may be set separately for the moment, and this can be done for the owner of those files or a group of the people or even anyone. So Unix stack also allows the owner of an object to set the security policies, and there's also a concept of a super user, which means that an entity which bypasses this Unix stack's policy. So basically, running a program with as a super user means that you have every rights to the system. So there is probably nothing which can stop you to access the critical information in the system itself. And this leads us to the problems which we had with this kind of system. So when the Unix stack was implemented by the Dennis Ritchie and the other people at the labs, the basic idea wasn't to provide a kind of security, but just to have a thin layer of the protection. And it also doesn't protect us with the flawed or the malicious code because of the super user identities. And as a super user, one can have all kind of accesses. It also violates the normal user's policy. And one also cannot express kind of modern security requirements of which this kind of model in the after this technological advancement in the same area. So also, user can invoke the system services by switching to the root users, like with the set UIDs. And it's basically a 9-bits model, so there's a RWX per owner for the group of the people or the other, like everyone. So these are some of the problems which we had with the Unix stack system, and that's how the features, security features were added into the Linux. So initially, when people started thinking about the security in the Linux operating system, when the users of the Linux operating system grown, the basic idea was just to extend the minimal things from this Unix dark features, and then the things were changed. So some of the features which were added initially are just the extensions of the Unix dark features. So say, first of all, the POSIX access control lists were added into the kernel. So the traditional POSIX system allows us to have the classes of users, for example, the single user, and then the group of a user, and then the everyone, and then we can have a permissions like a read and write, and a person can decide whom they want, what kind of user can have, or what kind of rights. For example, if a user want to decide that a certain kind of users can have rights, read accesses and not the write, so that can be added as a secure, that can be added over there, and that's how you manage the POSIX access control lists. So these are the kind of entry types which were which in according to the lists can be defined over there. So owner is the one who is the user itself and can have a read write and RWX access rights. Named user is the one where the user and the name, and then the RWX, so you can have the access rights over there. Also, and ACL consists the list of the entries over there, and the permissions of each file system object can have ACL representatives. And these things, access control lists, are managed by the setfscl and getfscl commands in the Linux kernel itself. Then the POSIX capabilities were added, and it was added as a solution of a problem with the super user. So when a process tries to do a privileged operation, the operating system checks whether the user have a efficient, effective set of the process. For example, a process tries to set up the clock, and the Linux kernel will check if the process has the sys time bit set over there, and then only they can access the clock. So it means that when an application requires a limited kind of privileges, they will not have the all kind of privileges, and this restricts them to perform the unintended actions over there. Also, a process has three sets of bitmaps called inheritable, permitted, and effective capabilities. So each capability is implemented as a bit, and according to these bits, the permissions are defined over there. After that, namespaces were added. So namespaces were derived from the Plan 9 operating system, which was a research project, extension of the Unix research project over there. And the partitioning resources can be seen by the process. So how it helps is each process can be launched with its own private temporary directory and invisible to other processes, and which works seamlessly with existing application code to eliminate the entire class of the security threats which are over there. So it's not a security feature as per, but it helps with implementing the kind of security features which can be needed. It have been used to help implement the multi-level security, where files are labeled with the security classifications and potentially entire hidden from the users. Cryptography API. So cryptography API is basically an implementation of the various cryptographical algorithms over there, and it's used by many kernel subsystems, including the commonly deployed. Commonly deployed ciphers, hash functions, and limited asymmetric cryptography algorithms are used over there. And the key management subsystem, it's a key management subsystem for managing the cryptography keys within the kernel. So mainly the cryptography API is used by the IPsec code and the disk encryption schemes and the kernel module signature verification schemes. There is also some of the work done for supporting the hardware-based cryptographic features. And after that, we have network security. So Linux is have a capable network security stack for supporting the many features, and it can be used both. So Linux's network security model can be used as an endpoint node on a network, or as a router passing the traffic between the interfaces. So kernel-level modules can be hooked into the framework to examine how we can examine the packets and how we can add the security features at that level. So the NetFilter project is an IP network layer framework which hooks these packets into the which hooks packets which passes through and from the system. Also, IP tables are the module, NetFilter module, which implements IPv4 firewalling scheme managed by the userland IP tables. And EB tables is for filtering, providing the filtering at the link layer. There's also ARP tables, which provides filtering at ARP packets. And IPsec is a network protocol suite which authenticates and encrypts the packets of data sent over the network. And it can also be used to implement the VPNs and the point-to-point security. So these were some of the things which were added independently. But now comes the part of adding the Linux security modules. So the issues which were there with because of the dark systems giving privileges to the user at some extent. So to come over with these limitations, we need to have a system like MAC, Mandatory Access Control System, which can give which a developer can add a certain kind of points to have the control over giving rights to the user or the group of the users. So Linux security module is implements hooks at all security critical points within the kernel. And MAC security differs from the dark in the security policy to administered centrally, and users do not administer policy for their own resources. So this helps to contain attacks which exploit the user-level software bugs and the misconfiguration. So LSM API also allows different security models to be plugged in the kernel, so typically access control frameworks. A user of the framework can register with the API and then can have receive callbacks from those hooks. And it was basically designed to provide the specific needs of everything needed to successfully implement a MAC system in the Linux kernel. So there are different kind of LSMs included into Linux kernel at the moment, and The first LSM which was included was SE Linux. So SE Linux is basically an implementation of the say fine-grained mandatory access control system, which to meet the say wide range of the security requirements which were needed at that time. And like from a general purpose use to the military and the government policies, SE Linux can be used to manage the classical information. So SE Linux, in SE Linux, all objects on the system are assigned as a security labels, and the security relevant information between entities on the system are hooked by LSM and passed to the SE Linux module, which consults its security policy to determine whether the operation should continue or not. Also, the security policy is loaded from user land and it can be modified. And SE Linux at the moment is implemented in all the Fedora-based operating system, and also Android security model uses SE Linux with some of their extensions from their side. SMAC. So the idea behind the author of a SMAC was to have a simple form of MAC security, and in response to the relative complexity which are provided by the SE Linux. So it basically works based with the file systems, which supports extended attributes, and it's a part of Tizen security architecture at the moment. Also, it has gained some popularity in the embedded system stuff, and I think one of the IoT operating system by Intel is also now using SMAC over there. AppArmor, it's a fundamentally different scheme to SE Linux and XMAX because it has no direct labeling and security policies are applied to the path names. It is, at the moment, it is shipped with Ubuntu and OpenSUSE, and basically it allows system administrators to restrict the program's capabilities, and it also features a learning mode where the security behavior of the application is observed and converted automatically into the security profile. And Tomoyo is another MAC system which implements the path-based security. It utilizes the learning mode similar to the AppArmor, where the behavior of the system is observed to enhance the security policy. And it also records the trees of process invocation described as domains. So say we have a system, and when the system boots from init as a series of tasks are invoked over there, and which lead us to logged into a user runtime on a shell and ultimately executing a command over there, say ping. So this particular chain of tasks is recorded and as a valid domain for the execution of that application, and other invocations which have not been recorded are just denied. So there is a tree over there, and then the other invocations which are not over there that can be denied. Also, when the protection is enabled, Tomoyo Linux restricts the process to the behaviors and the resources allowed by the administrator. It is more for the end users, and as of now, there has not yet been any real world implication or maybe like appreciable adoption of the Tomoyo in the industry. Yama, it's a collection of the dark security enhancement from the projects like GR security, and it enhanced the restrictions on, it has an enhanced restrictions on ptrace are implemented in YAMA. It was just added at the time to have the kind of, say, there was a GR security had the patches over there, and it was just added as a patch, and I don't think there has been much improvement in the module after that. Load pin is a fairly new LSM added in, I guess, 4.8 or 4.9, and it ensures that all kernel loaded files are loaded from the trusted device. So, say DM Verity or CD-ROM, it allows the systems that have a verified and unchangeable file system to enforce the modules, say kernel modules or the firmware loading modules, to restrictions without needing to sign the individual files. Audit subsystem, so it was first designed to meet the government certification requirements, but was later adopted by many Linux security modules over there, and other security components are also using it now. Audit logs are usually useful to track the security-related information or the system's behavior, and to detect what kind of stuff were going on when the things went wrong. So then we have a SecComp, so it was added as a mechanism which restricts the access to the system calls by processes. So the problem with the system call API is that it's a wide area, so it opens the wide area for the attacks as well. And like any other system, we also have bugs in the system call APIs. So the privileged nature of the kernel also can also allow the bugs via system call API. So to reduce the attack surface of the kernel by preventing applications from entering the system calls which are not needed can help to avoid those attacks. One of the prominent software solution using the SecComp can be a Docker. So Docker uses SecComp and as a primary feature, and it has subcommands over there which can be implemented. Original SecComp code was also known as mode 1, which provided access to only four system calls, which are the basic four system calls, read, write, exit, and signal return. And then there was an extension of the SecComp done by basically for the Google Chrome project. It's a SecComp BPF, and it's an arbitrary specification of which system calls are permitted for a process and integration with the audit logging. So also it's a configuration policy of the SecComp BPF is implemented with the Berkeley packet filter rules, which helps with the, say, extending some kind of security levels which are provided by the SecComp. And then we have an integrity management subsystem. So it's used to maintain the integrity of files of the system, and integrity measurement architecture component, IMA, performs runtime integrity measurement of files using the cryptographic hashes and comparing them with the valid hashes over there. Also, measurement performed by IMA may be logged with the audit subsystem, and also can be used as a remote attestation. Also, DM Verity module, so it's intended to be used as a part of the verified boot process, and where an appropriately authorized caller brings a device online, and then a trusted partition containing kernel modules to be loaded later. So it's basically a device mapper target which manages file integrity at the block level. But after adding this many subsystems separately, or say on the top of the kernel, some of the modules which went inside the kernels, is this level of security sufficient? And why it's not sufficient? Because when these days Linux being an operating system of a server or a desktop has transferred in being an operating system, a mobile operating system, now even IoT devices are using it. And when the operating system, this operating system has become a part of our day-to-day life, there is, it has also increased the chances of the attacks over there. So the Google, in the last 3 years, Google's Android security bug bounty program has shown the kind of attacks which can be done at the kernel level easily, and the kernel should be able to protect itself. So this leads us to think about the possible solutions over there. So one of the possible solutions can be have research, more research on this area, and have the tools which can find the bugs and detect them. So I'll just talk about some of the tools, and then why even tools are not the, say, perfect solution over there. So at the moment in the kernel, there are a wide range of static and dynamic analysis tools which are used, and in last 10 years, the research projects have grown. The university students or the PhD people have shown the interest in doing a more detailed research on the particular bug classes. But it's only useful when it's regularly the bugs are regularly detected, and to detect the bugs regularly, we need to run the tools regularly. So either you can also automate the system, or you can have maybe a person sitting over there to just run the tool over there. But that's not the solution over here. So it has limitations of the when we talk about the static analysis tools, we also have a limitations of the false positives, and this also needs to be documented. And because when the maybe a person who has developed the tool knows that what kind of false positive are given for by case by case basis, but probably a person who is just new to the tool and just running it over the code may not know that this case has this kind of false positives given by the particular tool. So it's somehow hard to also get the exact bugs, and probably it can end up having a chaos over there. So some of the tools which are widely used in the Linux kernel at the moment. So first is a Sparse, which was written by Linus Torvalds and then was maintained by Josh. It provides a set of annotations designed to convey the semantic information about the types. So initially, it was helping to detect the Indian-related bugs, but then it also the features were also extended to give a warnings about unsupported operations or the type mismatches with the restricted integer types. It also warns about any non-static variable or a function definition that has no declaration. And there are, say, more than 6,000 patches submitted where the bugs were detected using SPARS. SMH, so SMH is returned by Dan Carpenter, and it gives you a kind of issue. It tackles the issues which are like null pointer dereference, error pointer dereference, and uninitialized data, some kind of information leaks. But it also have higher chances of false positives, say 30 to 40%. So it's not, so the tool it's to have the automated system, the tool itself is not added in the Linux kernel, but it is widely used by the Den and some other developers time to times to solve the, to detect the issues. Also, Den tries to run this tool over the new patches which are submitted into the Linux kernel. And also there's a zero-day testing robot in the Linux kernel. And the idea of zero-day testing robot is, say, give the build. What zero-day testing robot does is, when every patch is submitted into the Linux kernel subsystem mailing lists, it picks a patch over there from there, and it runs it on the 20 to 25 other architectures, and then gives the build system errors and directly submits the result to the submitter of a patch. So with this, it also runs some of these scripts, which are coccinell scripts or the SMH scripts, which helps to give these bugs, which reports these bugs directly over there before it's been added into the mainline kernel. So both of these tools are used by zero-day testing robot. Not all of the scripts. So the scripts which have more chances to have the false positives are not preferred to add into the zero-day testing robot, but some of the scripts which has, say, high level of trust from the author of the script and the developers based on the results given by the script can be added into the system. So coccinell is also other pattern matching and transformation tool. There are few scripts which are already added into the kernel itself, and like I said, zero-day testing robot also runs some of these scripts separately. It has its so it's not, it not only detects the bug, but it also fixes the bug. So the script can be the tool itself have a language called semantic patch language. And how we write the script is in the Git patch form. So you can remove the line, and you can add the lines based on the pattern of the bug. So when you run those scripts, you not only gives the script not only gives you the warnings, but it also just fixes the code by itself. So this is also one of the advantage of this tool. It handles few security issues like null pointer dereference and use of sleeping functions under locks, use of TFree, a few other locking related bugs like double locks or the missing of unlock, etc. Another widely used tools, obviously the compiler itself, but GCC also have some advancement since last 2-3 versions, and there are many other new security warnings, security related warnings are added. So GCC also GCC plugins helps with the handling the specific kind of bugs when you don't want to add the code into the compiler itself. So say you have a bug class and you want to solve the particular type of bugs, then you can use the GCC plugin API and write a plugin And then it can detect the bugs over there based on the plugin written. So as of now, there are 5 GCC plugins added into the Linux kernel. And so basically, not all of them are security related. The one we have also cyclomatic complexity, which helps you to just at the edge of having detecting some kind of security issues, but it's not a kind of a GCC plugin which just gives you a result about the to handle a certain kind of bug classes. But then also there is plugins like randomizing structures layout at the compile time, or maybe like detecting any structures that contain a user attributes and make sure that it is being fully initialized. There is also a structure leak plugin, which is and all plugin written over here. We have all of this plugin were actually initially written, or maybe was as a part of GR security, and they are mainly written by MEC RevP, and the project was actually funded by the CII at that time. Also, we have two widely used fuzzers in the Linux kernel. So Trinity was developed by Dave Jones, and it helps with mainly giving a oops. Over there are many CVEs, as a proof that this kind of things were oops were can so actually the, when the tool was developed, it was developed based on that some of the CVE, I mean, by him to make things more reliable, and it also detects the locking related bugs and memory leaks, etc. Cscaler, it's developed recently, like 3 or 4 years ago, and it's developed by Dimitri and the team at Google. It also helps with the resource and memory information leaks. There is also a list on the projects wiki that what kind of CVEs are handled by the tool or the detected by the tool. And they also helps in handling the deadlocks. There are some advancement in the American Fuzzy Loop, which was which was a successful project at the user level. And in the last year, in the last 2 years, there is a proof that it can be used successfully at the kernel level as well. And also there are address sanitizers and thread sanitizers, etc., to help us with the particular kind of bugs, like data races. But then again, is fixing bugs sufficient? Because if we need to fix the bug, or we need to fix the individual bugs, then I don't think that is something like at security level. Because the code is changing, and every day there are hundreds of lines committed into the kernel itself. Also, it's important that when an individual bug is fixed, it is fixed into the latest kernel. So it's also important to understand that this fix should be added into the stable kernel, and the device manufacturers are adding or maybe updating their code over there. Also, if they are updating the code, are the updates going to the users itself? And say you have a mobile which you have purchased from a device manufacturer 5 years ago, and there are many security bugs which were there at the time when your device manufacturer added that kernel. But then when you get the updates, the new updates comes to you after a 1 year or 2 years, and then it gives the attacker a window because they already know that this bug is fixed into the new kernel, but it's not fixed in your phone's system. So it's also important that with the mobiles, the thing is probably you will change it after, say, 5 or 6 years. But when we are in the IoT space, and say we have a door lock system or the alarm system at the door, we are not going to change it for, maybe we are developers, so maybe we are going to do that, but what about the normal user? They are just purchasing, they have just fixed it over there in their system, and it will stay over there for 10 years. And maybe a person knows that what kind of things are used in that system, but the user itself doesn't. So fixing bugs is not sufficient as of now, and we need a system where a kernel should be able to help itself with the security stuff. So this leads us to the next project, which is currently going on into the Linux kernel, and it's a kernel self-protection project. So the basic idea behind the kernel self-protection project was to that the kernel should be able to protect itself, and bugs have longer lifetimes. As of now, the current focus in this project is to upstream the GR security and PAX features, and also here, whatever work is going on, we are trying to kill the bug classes and not the individual bugs. So you can also see Case Cook's blog, and he has actually written he writes the blog for each of the new kernel. So what kind of features from the kernel self-protection projects are added over there can be seen. And yes, in the conclusion, we have come far from the Unix Dark security to a kernel self-protection project, maybe. But there's always a scope of the research, because there are bug classes. With the advancement of the technologies, the advancement of the bug classes are increased as well. And security, it has been said in this conference many times, but maybe we can say one more time that security is no longer a buzzword, but maybe a necessity. So, and I'd like to see more work at the kernel level. As I said, there are many CVEs which can, we have our pages, say 10 pages in the first 2 months with the CVEs which can be handled, and we can have the next features in the Linux kernel. So yes, and there are resources which you can just check regarding the separate projects. I also have the slides of my talk which I gave on which has all of the tools, the introduction of the tools and how those tools works, and what which tool is particularly useful for which kind of bug classes. So you can just go for that. And yes, Linux Security Summit videos are good too. Thanks.
Yeah, questions, please. As questions might be a bit more complicated, Carsten proposed, and I will walk around and hand over the microphone then. So, questions, please. Carsten, already the first one. I'm jumping.
You mentioned a GCC plugin to randomize the layout of structures. So an attacker doesn't know the layout in memory. how is that applied? Because I can imagine that you cannot reasonably randomize all structures in the kernel.
Yeah.
You have to pass structures to user space. Sometimes structures represent hardware layouts. Do you have to tag structures to be randomized, or how does that work?
Sorry?
Do you have to tag each individual structure so that the plugin randomizes it, or how does the compiler know which structure it can safely randomize and which must be kept as is, for example, because it is passed to user space?
I'm not sure to understand the question, actually. So you're asking that how a plugin picks the particular structure? That's what you're asking?
Yes. I guess that it is not safe to randomize all structures used by the kernel, so that some of the structures must be kept in their normal form. How does the plugin know which structures can be randomized and which cannot? Do they get tagged?
Yeah.
Is there a label on them? How does that work?
Let me come over. We have more kernel experts here than I would have ever imagined. It's great.
No, I'm not really an expert, but I have looked into the GR security patch, and it's almost the same idea, I think. Hopefully, it is.
Yeah.
So it's tagged by a keyword. A macro expands to nothing if the plugin is not present. Okay?
Thanks. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is inside of the tool, right, that you mentioned. So,
yes.
Yeah. So thank you very
much.
Yeah. Okay.
And this leads always to merge conflicts.
Yeah. So, shall we write a memo of this and send it to the developer so that he knows about the merge conflicts and stuff? So maybe he takes care of it. So. Sure. Okay. More questions. Okay. If this is not the sure. Let me just go ahead.
I think many problems, security related problems, partly addressed by GR security, are a result of the memory model the kernel is using. This means you know from academic research some things like microkernels or even nanokernels or the like. And I think the main idea behind them is having, even in kernel space, separate address spaces, virtual address spaces, separating concerns or isolating is the correct term.
Yeah.
Here, isolating, for example, device drivers from each other or from the file system code and so on. And I think there was a very old discussion between Andrew Tannenbaum and the other people about this. It's not a new question, but do you know of any ideas of at least using some of those concepts in the kernel?
Not at the moment, I guess.
No, I think this is just the basic problem, the biggest class of classes you have mentioned.
Yes.
It's just the memory model as such, this big single address space.
I'm absolutely not an expert in this. I would guess this would boil down to something like sandboxing in the kernel space, right? So, I mean, first only in the address space and then also execution, blah, blah, blah. But it's basically something like you have in user land or in iOS or Android, so with sandboxing, and you would then transform this in the kernel. What's about performance issues then? So, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, if we need to advance anything in the kernel, then we also need to ensure that nothing should be break which on the systems which are running.
In my opinion, performance problem need, for example, you can just enable it for testing and for finding bugs or for finding problems. And in some production kernels where performance is more important than security, you can disable it. And if you have a very very security-aware systems where performance does not matter that much, you will enable it for production kernels this way. just as an idea. So it need not be a general feature.
Yeah, that's the idea, that performance should not be compromised on the law. Performance should not be, even you want to add the security stuff. So, and that's how it took a time for the people to adapt the parks or GR security stuff and to, you know, get used with the idea that the security is important and it should be in the main line itself as well.
Not a question, rather comment. The issue with the address space separation fails when you get to DMA. Is the common case.
So you would need to have really separate address spaces for direct memory access, sure, which is a very important performance feature, right?
I think there's a partly solution. You are right, the problem is existing, but a part solution could be, for example, DMA is typically used in device drivers and low-level drivers only, then you hand over, like similar to mailboxing, but handing over the access rights to some pages to other parts of the kernel, for example, between the driver and the file systems at some appropriate places. So, of course, it's a complicated system and it's no real good solution, but it could help in determining some of the problems or alleviating some of them.
Another question over there.
I have a question on the firmware files that I sometimes have to download for the kernel. Are there any checks on these firmware files, especially, or are they just provided by the vendor of the hardware?
Yeah, it's provided by the hardware, as far as I know.
So,
the thing which I over here. So I think at some point integrity measurement system helps over there, but I don't think the actual implementation at say for all kind of checks are done at the kernel level.
What are you distrusting? Do you distrust the hardware vendor, the processor vendor? If you do, then you shouldn't buy that processor anyway. Because if the processor itself has some hidden features you don't know about, you have no chance. Whether it's in firmware or not does not matter. If there is any hidden functionality you don't know, undocumented functionality, for example, the supervisor mode, bypass the supervisor mode, is only one bit in the processor, telling whether you are working in ring zero or not. If this is compromised in some way, you are off anyway. You know of this dirty cow bug, for example, last autumn. It's a kernel bug which leads to, you can write to any arbitrary page, any arbitrary, even if it's write protected or not belonging to you. So these kind of bugs are so generic, and this class of bugs is really an important problem, and it has to be solved somehow. But it's not possible without trusting the hardware vendors, I think. And there are some bugs in this area, known bugs, which have been fixed in the past. And the unknown bugs, of course, is the next problem. But if you really want to have security, then use your Commodore 64 again. I think, yes. So it has 1,200 transistors, and you can check them all by hand.
Okay. Yeah. But I think there will be a lot of discussion after this talk as well. There was a question over there. I think we got a special interest group in kernel security here just building up.
Hello, and thanks for your talk. All the time people here think about desktop systems and servers mainly. But during the last years, we are talking about or seeing many embedded systems without any control entering networks, being delivered with a safe state of kernel and distribution, and then changed or being in an unsafe environment and completely run over by an update with the different features. Just imagine your Sony is watching you from the firmware with the next update and streaming live to Facebook with a cam of your smart TV that you own yourself. It's an embedded system that you don't have a control over. You have to trust the manufacturer, and you don't have any instance of control about changing the routines and the functionality of it. Imagine your set receiver. It has a 100 megabit connect to your local network. Your DAB radio, your smartphone. Every update you have to trust, and you don't have verification processes for the kernel and for the first safe state when you bought it. And everything which is coming after it, which you hopefully have security issues fixed in there, might be also a negative surprise. And I don't see any systematic protection against those dangers. Thank you.
Probably less of a question, but more of a concern, right?
It's just the concept.
Yeah.
The concept is still missing. About having a safe state and no changes of this state.
Sure. But this is then, to me, from my understanding, I'm correct me if I'm wrong, this is on a high level. I mean, this is when somebody puts in something malicious and puts in some spyware on those devices, for instance, or that get hacked. Sure.
Get hacked. From Amazon, you get it but from China, from Hong Kong, and you have no manufacturer on it.
Do you see any possibilities to rectify this problem on the kernel level? So are there concepts? I'm not aware of them. It should be. Yeah, okay, I get the point. Yeah.
And that's still missing. You're just thinking of, I have to protect my process in there. If there's a hacker who just reads out shared memory and I have to obfuscate all tasks and shift it over and protect my process from cryptographic, but you don't have the protection of all these things that you will get in the next 5 years. Think of internal proofs.
I'm not sure if we will solve it. Please go ahead if you have some comment to that.
Yes. So, I mean, as a mainline community, you can't force the device manufacturers to just have these things. But as a users, you can. So it's because you are the one who are using those products. And probably, yes, companies should take these things. And that's how the kernel self-protection is working on as well, because then if you have these features lying over there where the kernel itself is able to prevent attacks, then the possibility of the attacks can be reduced. So,
yeah, a lot of questions and discussion still to do, but we're running out of time. Thank you, Carsten. Exactly. So thank you very much, and thank you coming that long way. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.